You know that the secret to making the best coffee is starting with beans that have been freshly roasted. But most coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe could have been roasted months before it got to you. Which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and your next new favorite. They even offer a rotating seasonal blend for the more adventurous coffee drinkers among us. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers that exceptional coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries and never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. Start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Sound good?
Yes, sir!
As it turns out, actually, you're due for some new Sparkplug coffee. So I said to them, we need some more coffee. And they said, oblige them.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Buongiorno. And grazie. For putting some dazzle in your day by listening to the next 158 project. The Monday morning deep dive into classic motion pictures. Our hook when we started doing this over 6 years ago was to review the 123 classics on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of 100 years, 100 movies. Everything we've ever done is online and it's free. I'm the mastermind behind Operation Kino, who's unaware a courageous lady is going to kill my enemies for me, Ryan Ellis. And here's my podcasting partner who's been chewed out for, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Inglourious Bastards. Not counting laughing, grunting, or screaming, what are the last words of Colonel Landa, Adolf Hitler, and Lieutenant Rain?
Colonel Landa's last word is, "You'll be shot for this!"
Mm-hmm.
Hitler's last words are, "Enough! Stop it!"
Mm-hmm.
And then Rain's last words in the film, which are also the last lines in the film, you know something.
I think this just might be my masterpiece.
And then directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, a lot of people have pointed out that that's an arrogant thing by Tarantino.
Well, he's not a humble man.
He's not, that's true. I actually thought of this because I remember one of the great laughs. This is not one of his funnier movies. Because it is pretty violent and bloody and it's based on reality, which he really didn't do in most of his films until he started doing this. And now with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which comes out very soon, which is why we're doing this movie now for one reason. But I thought maybe Hitler's last line was when he says to Goebbels,
"Best film you've made
yet.
This
is the best you've made yet." The look on that guy's face. Guy plays Goebbels. True laugh out loud moment.
He could have said at that moment, "I can die now." It's actually a gift that he dies in that moment because I don't think anything in his life ever made him so happy. And even his little girlfriend, who seems to loathe him in some way in the film, but even she is moved to touch his shoulder like, oh my God.
Yeah, Julie Dreyfus from Kill Bill. Playing a similar role.
Oh my God, I never even recognized her.
She's Oren Ishii's assistant. But the way that Sylvester Groth, who plays Goebbels, plays that, oh my God, I laughed out loud. I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times now, and I've watched that moment more than a few times because I had to find out. I thought Hitler's last line was, "Your best movie yet," but it's not. It's enough, stop it. But watching that again, that is so funny.
Everything Brad Pitt says and does in this movie is hilarious.
Not everything, but he's the funniest person in general. Including the buongiorno. He can't speak Italian. I speak the best Italian. Donovitz is second best. Ulmer's the third best. I don't speak Italian. Although I read online that of the three of them, when he actually says anything, he does have the best accent of them. Ulmer is his name. That's the character's name.
He looks Italian, too.
I love when they're all being introduced to Landa and he does that little hand gesture that Italians supposedly do. It's really funny.
That's an incredible scene as far as what Landa is putting them through in that scene, because of course he knows they're not Italian and he's just torturing them.
He always fucks with people, at least 3 different times, maybe even 4 different times. We'll get into that in a few minutes, though. Okay, after being screened at a series of festivals, Quentin Tarantino's badly spelled revisionist history was released about a month shy of 10 years ago by Universal and the Weinstein Company. That was back when Quentin always worked with Harvey Weinstein. And that was on August 21st, 2009. Success! It is Quentin Tarantino's third biggest hit adjusted for inflation. The only two that are bigger when you adjust would be Pulp Fiction and Django Unchained. And interestingly, one of the connections with this movie, it would be to one of his idols, I would say. Martin Scorsese would fit that bill for Tarantino because Taxi Driver is one of his favorite films. Both of them, as they got older, became the prestige guys, became the hit makers. Neither one of them were the big box office guys. Okay, Pulp Fiction was, but Tarantino had a small hit in Reservoir Dogs. Jackie Brown overall was not a big hit. The Kill Bill movies, Death Proof, part of Grindhouse, not big hits. But then this, and Django Unchained, and they probably hoped for Hateful Eight, they certainly hope Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, are getting a marquee release. Either Christmas time for Tarantino, which is often been the case, or in this case now, the middle of the summer with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And Scorsese is the same, where he became this guy who made these movies that didn't get a lot of Oscar nominations. But then whatever it was, with Gangs of New York and The Aviator, The Departed, all those kinds of films suddenly got these prestige releases. And generally, Scorsese became, by his standards, a hitmaker. And Tarantino is the same.
Which is funny because those three films you just named of Scorsese's are pretty far from what anybody would consider the best films of his career. Maybe right. The Departed would be on the short list. I think most people wouldn't even include any of those movies in their top five Scorsese films.
No, but I'm just saying as far as what the studios did as far as positioning these movies, and then the fans doing as far as attending these movies.
People caught up with them. I think that they were both ahead of their time. That's mm-hmm. a part of it. Tarantino in particular. He was so influential that whether people saw his movies at the time or not, filmmakers saw his movies, and they certainly started making films and TVs to reflect his sensibility, but still nobody's ever done it better than him, so now when his movies come out, I think we're a little more primed. Although it's hard for me to say, because I've always loved his movies. Mm-hmm. I saw Reservoir Dogs when I was in high school and loved it. I think I saw Reservoir Dogs after Pulp Fiction had already come out, so I can't say I was right there at the very beginning, but I was very young as well. At any rate, I've been a fan of his since the beginning.
He's a guy, yeah, you're not going to miss his films.
So we're an exception in that way. But to say, like, Django Unchained was his biggest hit is such a crazy thing to me. I wouldn't put that in my top five Quentin Tarantino movies. But I would put Inglourious Basterds in.
Me too. Definitely. Django was second biggest, though. Because
adjusted for inflation, maybe.
Yes.
As far as money made, Django is his number one film.
Okay, Bev, remind people what this 10-year-old movie's about. Although I think they probably know. But it is complex, so tell them what it's about with the Inglourious Basterds skinny.
Once upon a time in Nazi-occupied France, Brad Pitt's Lieutenant Aldo Raine commands a mostly Jewish militia called the Bastards, whose violent tactics spread fear among German soldiers. When intelligence reveals that many of the top Nazi leaders, including the Führer himself, will be attending a film premiere in Paris, they develop a plan to sabotage it, killing everyone inside. Meanwhile, Melanie Laurent Shoshana, a French-Jewish woman, barely survives an SS ambush, and then goes on to disguise her heritage and move to Paris, where she runs a cinema. When she is forced to host a film premiere that will be attended by many top Nazis, including the Führer himself, she develops a plan to sabotage it, killing everyone inside.
Lucky break. They want to kill Hitler at the
what
same
a coincidence.
Time.
People really hate that Hitler guy.
I don't know why. I have no idea. Two small issues I want to take with that, actually. You said a mostly Jewish militia, and the whole point is they're all Jewish characters, are they not? Raine himself is not Jewish, but that's the point.
Yeah,
he's
Raine himself
recruiting
is not
Jewish people.
What about Hugo Stiglitz? Is he Jewish?
He's
I thought
German.
He was German. Also, Michael Fassbender's character is not.
Well, but
Jewish,
he's not one of the Bastards, I guess. He's
isn't he?
Recruited later on.
Okay, so anyways, Hugo Stiglitz.
Stiglitz
is not Jewish.
Okay, I guess that's
and
fair.
Raine himself is not Jewish, so that's why I said that's mostly Jewish.
Okay, fair. And also, one more small point. You just called them the Bastards, and of course Mike Myers says, the Bastards.
The Bastards.
But it actually is, and I had forgotten this, on the gun, when we see Aldo Raine set it aside, the first time we see them actually in action in Europe, leading up to when that guy gets his head bashed in by Donny Donowitz, Eli Roth, which could have been Adam Sandler, apparently, but he was making funny people instead. Inglourious Basterds, whatever, is actually written on the stock of his gun.
Oh.
The full two-word phrase. And speaking of the bad spelling in this movie, Tarantino said he won't explain why it's misspelled. He never has, because that would ruin the mystique of it.
The Bastards are not educated men, so they would misspell it themselves. Particularly Aldo Raine doesn't seem to be a book-learning type of guy.
I bet you're onto what it is then.
Funny that Sandler could have played the Bear Jew. I always trust Tarantino. The man has never really failed at casting just about any part. But I cannot imagine Adam Sandler playing this part.
Distracting?
I tried. I believe he could do it. I believe that Adam Sandler is a better actor than he's ever really made himself be.
He was good in Funny People the same year.
He's good in Funny People, yeah, the same year. And he was also good in Punch Drunk Love. He has depths that he just doesn't bother really exploring because I think his silly movies just make him enough money, and why wouldn't he carry on with this career? I don't blame him at all for sticking to what works. But God, can you even imagine him playing that part?
Yes, I can. But I think Eli Roth, for a non-actor, Eli Roth did a damn good job.
Agreed.
And I always think of the moment when he's shredding Hitler with that machine gun.
Oh, yeah.
I think they do that to make doubly sure that no one could ever say, well, maybe he survived that theater bombing. Although no one did, obviously.
The whole thing is fantasy fulfillment. The film was criticized in a way for failing to respect the moral gravity of the war. But we've seen those films. And
right.
We've read those books.
Yeah.
Aren't we allowed to just indulge in the enjoyment of watching a bunch of war criminals in their Sunday best, clambering towards the doors like trapped rats, while Jewish soldiers shoot them from the balcony, or shoot their faces to ribbons like they did with Hitler? I know it's not real. I know it's a fantasy. We're aggressively reminded by the glaring historical fiction of it all. So what is its value? Is there no value in just watching the villains get got? When the moment comes, the tension has been built to bursting, and we are rewarded with this exquisite, gory catharsis. And I'll be damned if someone's going to tisk-tisk me into feeling bad for enjoying it.
Okay, fair. We'll get to that later on, though, the ending. There's a lot to talk about, but I haven't done my nutshell yet, so I'll just do that now. So, in a nutshell, Once Upon a Time in the West showed us, and this movie teaches the same lesson, always kill the children. Don't let the children live to come back to haunt you. Harmonica proved it, and now Shoshana proves it. And incidentally, her name, I'm looking at it right now in the IMDb credits, and it's also in Landa's ledger, is spelled Shoshana. There's no H there, but everyone pronounces it, including her boyfriend Marcel. We Shoshana. Everyone says Shoshana, so I'm just going to say Shoshana. It sounds...
I just assume that's how Shoshana was spelled. I don't think I've ever seen it written down. It's not a particularly common name.
Well, if we're wrong in saying Shoshana on this podcast, I don't care. We're going to say that. But I'm looking at it right now, and it does say Shoshana. Let's get through the numbers on Inglourious Basterds. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 88% of critics and audiences, exact same number, like this movie. 283 fresh reviews for the critics, 37 rotten, for an average of 7.8 out of 10, and it's 93rd on the IMDb's 250. He's like Christopher Nolan and Fincher, probably. These directors who've only made a certain amount of movies, and most of them seem to be honored by the IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, all the rest.
Popular among the type of people who rate movies on IMDb.
And incidentally, the only Quentin Tarantino movie without a fresh tomato is Four Rooms. But that is an ensemble piece. He's one of four directors, and people said his piece was, if not the best, one of the best. Him and Robert Rodriguez with his one about the kids, the prelude to Spy Kids, as it turned out. And then Death Proof and The Hateful Eight are a little less than 75% on Rotten Tomatoes, but the rest of his movies are pretty highly ranked there. So the critics liked almost everything he's ever done, and I'm guessing they're going to like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Prediction right now, I won't be the first person to say this, looks like revisionist history with the Manson murders.
Oh, well, no, very shortly. I think it did pretty well at Cannes.
No, I'm just talking about what they're going to do with the storyline.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are going to maybe both die, but try to stop the Manson murders from happening. So Sharon Tate maybe lives in this revisionist history, but that's a prediction. A little bit more on the numbers. Inglourious Basterds was 25th at the 2009 U.S. box office. We've covered Avatar, which was number 1. Up, we covered very recently, was number 5. And The Hurt Locker, which we covered a few months ago, was 116th. Basterds was nominated for 8 Oscars. It won 1. Christoph Waltz, of course, for Supporting Actor, which was a damn good choice. It was also nominated for Best Picture. Best Director, Tarantino, the screenplay by Tarantino, the editing, the last movie that Sally Menke ever edited, for Tarantino at least. I think she maybe edited something else.
She did one more. There was one more credit that followed in Glorious Bastards. I mean, you never know with release dates or what have you. Her best work truly was what she did with Tarantino, and this was the last one she ever made. And I've said this before, he hasn't made a great film since she died.
Some would say Django was great, but I don't think we agree.
Django was good.
Good, but not great.
Django had some great scenes, and I liked a lot of things about it, but it felt indulgent. All his films feel a little bit indulgent, but...
Maybe she fought him in the editor suite.
Yeah, I really feel like she must have reined him in a way that maybe nobody else can.
I think it's Fred Raskin who's editing him now.
Who was her assistant.
Okay.
She was his editor from Reservoir Dogs.
When he was a kid.
When he was a kid, and she had more experience than he did. They probably came into that relationship where she had a certain level of influence and power because she was a professional and he was brand new.
She had edited...
He would have to rely on her.
the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Bev.
Hello!
So therefore, she was the player and he was not.
But she was! I'm sorry, a new director is going to lean on their main crew like that, be it the cinematographer, the very good veteran actors he had in Reservoir Dogs, and people like your editor. And obviously, he respected her opinion. They collaborated on all these films.
The only person I think he's worked with in every single movie, well, I guess Lawrence Bender. Also, this was his last movie that Tarantino and he made together.
Oh.
Although, if they do make another Kill Bill movie, and there is talk of that, then Bender apparently would produce it. But Bender didn't produce Hateful Eight, Django, and I don't think he's involved in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, that's another thing. Your producer can have a tremendous amount of influence. They are, in most cases, the ones that have the final say in what actually makes it to
screen.
Harvey
Weinstein has the final say.
Well, Harvey Weinstein had the final say. Also, Tarantino is a pretty powerful director, mm-hmm. and I doubt that he answers to very many people.
And forgetting the controversy with Harvey, let's not get too far into that. We've talked about another podcast. We know he's an asshole. We know he's terrible. And maybe Tarantino enabled him. But just Harvey as a filmmaker, as a producer, Tarantino's a good example of somebody who fought back and said, I'm fucking right and you're fucking wrong. No, you're not. Yes, I am. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
A lot of other people, and I don't blame them if they're artists. Maybe they're just not the type of people who want to fight some Hollywood mogul who obviously was a bullying asshole all along. Again, forgetting what he did to people behind the scenes. We know he was a bullying asshole publicly all this time.
Before that, yeah.
And people like Bernardo Bertolucci and maybe John Madden, the guy who did Shakespeare in Love, they were more shrinking violets. Tarantino would get in there and scuffle with Weinstein, and maybe Weinstein liked that. And these guys were a great combination. So we'll see if Tarantino, who's not got that many more movies in him, apparently, according to him, he doesn't want to make movies until he's 65, 70 years old. He doesn't want to keep on going and be a director for hire and suck. He said that many times.
Yeah, I mean, so he you should say be... that until you're in the position where you should give it up.
Now, Star Trek is apparently in his sight lines, which seems like a very strange combination for them.
I mean, that's been in rumors for a long time, too.
It does say announced on the IMDb. That may not be true long-term, because I've talked about Bryan Singer was announced for doing Red Sonja, and that's not on there anymore.
I love Star Trek, and I love Tarantino, but I just do not need to see the combination of those two things.
Fucking engage.
The captain is Sam Jackson.
That motherfucker's illogical. And I won't use the other word that Tarantino loves to use a lot, which he used a lot in Django especially. Okay, the nominations for Oscars. Let's get back to that. Cinematography by Robert Richardson, who's also become a Tarantino regular now, ever since the first Kill Bill, I believe. Also, the sound and the sound effects. So, 7 nominations it didn't win, and it lost almost all of those to The Hurt Locker.
Hmm.
I think the only one it didn't actually lose out to was cinematography, which I believe went to Avatar. But picture, director, the screenplay, the editing, the sound, and the sound effects all went to The Hurt Locker, which were good choices in most or even all those categories. But if Tarantino was ever going to win an Oscar after not having one for Pulp Fiction, maybe he should have way back then, this would have been the right choice. I guess you would agree with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It did win one Oscar.
And maybe the right one.
Best Supporting Actor for Christoph Waltz.
I had never heard of that guy. And I looked him up just a few hours ago. He has been working, or had been working, I should say, at that point for about 30 years in TV and movies.
Yeah, he did a lot of European television.
I'd heard of Ordinary Decent Criminal, but everything else, I looked at his resume, don't recognize it at all. And apart from the Tarantino collaborations, because he won an Oscar again for Django Unchained for supporting actor. But everything in between those two movies and then since then really doesn't stand out that much. I'm not saying he's not a good actor, because clearly in this one role, he is Anthony Perkins in Psycho. He is
the Joker.
The iconic actors. Even if they were good in anything else, and Perkins was good in other things, but he'll always be Norman Bates. Heath Ledger will be other things, actually, even though he was great as the Joker. But Christoph Waltz in this one role, where he speaks 4 languages, I think fluently, seems to be fluently to me, speaks English, German, French, and Italian in one movie. And apparently Leonardo DiCaprio was Tarantino's first choice, and I guess he didn't go with him for 2 reasons. One, he wasn't available, I think, but also maybe he realized the guy can't speak these languages.
Tarantino said that he didn't know he could make the film until he cast Waltz. Waltz gave him his movie because he was just so afraid that part, as he wrote it, was unplayable. The fact that I had never seen him before, and he comes out in this bomb of screen presence and charisma, but also pitch-perfect evil. He's such a great villain. He's very smart. He's cunning. Motivated by nothing but the pleasure he derives from his job. He's not dedicated to the cause. He only looks out for himself, but he is dedicated to being a hunter. He's almost like a cat. He likes to thrill the chase. And this job is just this perfect match for him. Toys with his prey, sometimes quite elaborately with these mind games. It just gives him pleasure, but he's always in immense control of himself.
He's a hawk going after a rat, as he says to La Petite early on in that opening scene.
But he gets the rat because he can think like a rat.
I think you could say that in 1941, when that happens, that he's on board with the Nazis, and he's fine with all that they're doing. But by the end of the movie, in 1944, years have passed, and he sees that they're starting to go down now. Or is it 1945? Anyway, one of those. I think it's 44. Either way, the Nazis are not on top anymore, and it looks like maybe they're going to get toppled. And that's probably why he makes the deal, or even wants to make the deal that he does with the Americans, because he realizes, this side's not going to win, and I'll play myself against the middle and get the best deal I can for myself. But I think early on in the film, in that opening scene, he's full bore in favor of what's going on with the Nazis. Oh, yes, sure. He's doing his job, but I think there's an element of if the Nazis just disappeared and he was still in that farmhouse, he'd still say to those guys, shoot through the floor and kill all these rats.
Yeah, he is a Nazi and he's evil in all the ways that Nazi is a shorthand for evil. But he will be evil regardless whether the Nazis came into power or not. There are these repeated poignant reminders in the film, mostly in performance cues by the supporting actors that remind us he's also used the rise of the Nazis to get himself in a position of tremendous power, and he has no compunction about wielding it.
The opening with Landa is one of the great sit-and-talk scenes in Quentin Tarantino's career, and that's really saying something, because the opening of Reservoir Dogs, his first ever movie, forgetting My Best Friend's Wedding, I don't think of that as his first movie, even though it's on the IMDb and he made it, but Reservoir Dogs, at the diner. There's a scene like that in Death Proof. There's a lot of sit-and-talk scenes in Tarantino's movies, Pulp Fiction, of course, with Jules and Vincent. But the opening is just Landa being so polite and also just fucking with Lapidite because he can't, because he wants to. He knows where he's going with this whole thing. I'd forgotten how long that scene is. It's about 15 minutes. It reminded me also of a movie we just covered 2 weeks ago, Once Upon a Time in the West. The lengthy opening that leads to an inevitable conclusion. In that one, you got three guys waiting for Bronson. And then a gunfight happens and Bronson happens to win. He could have just as easily lost that gunfight, but he does actually win it. But the long build-up, tension, and release of violence. Same with this. The long build-up, tension, and then finally when Landa switches to English and he starts talking about the Jewish people under the floorboards. I forget the exact cue. I should have wrote it down. When the camera goes down and you see what's underneath them. And that's when you feel, oh, shit.
That's when he lets the audience in so that we understand what is truly at stake here. Before that, you see through all the many cues, particularly the fear in the farmer's eyes, the reaction of the daughters. Landa, like you said, he's very polite, but it's kind of like a weapon that he wields, because he'll say to him, oh, it's your home. Mm-hmm. Oh, if you could, if you'd be ever so kind to do this and this and this, as if he can't demand and take anything he wants. It's very clear just by the performances of the farmer and his daughters. Then there's a shot where the daughter's about to go get him wine and he grabs her wrist and insists that he would like some milk instead. That's what he prefers. There's so much of a power dynamic in that performance where he's performing politeness, but he's actually very intentionally toying with them. When the camera very slowly dips down and we see what's really going on under the floorboards, you see Shoshana with her hand over her mouth and the panic that's going on down there, and then you know that the farmer's lying, and then it just takes the scene up to this next level. There's the famous Alfred Hitchcock line about you could have a scene where a bomb's about to go off.
That surprise.
In that surprise. Or tell the audience the bomb is there and make them watch these people not knowing the bomb is there have a conversation about anything. Baseball, I think, is the example he uses.
And that's suspense.
That's the moment where the audience is in on what's going on and the tension suddenly becomes so extreme that it's almost unbearable. It's a masterpiece of a scene. A lot of screenwriters study the scene. It's a great example of how to get your audience invested and to use something as simple as conversation to build that tension. Of course, it helps when you have some of the greatest actors perform this scene. Although the actor who plays Pierre Lapidite, I've never seen before, since I assume he's a French actor.
Denis Ménochet, I don't know.
He's amazing, though. Tarantino also notoriously gets amazing performances out of actors. Actors who I've otherwise seen be terrible in just about everything else, like Michael Madsen, who in everything that is not a Tarantino film, I consider to be a truly god-awful actor, but wonderful in every Tarantino thing I've ever seen him in. And this scene sets us up for one of the greatest villains of the century.
I mentioned Once Upon a Time in the West with the opening, but I guess it's also similar to Pulp Fiction, because Jules, same thing. He knows he's going to kill this guy. Once they get the briefcase, that's the most important thing, and they get their guy out of there, their plant, the Marvin guy. Okay, they're supposed to kill Brad and those other guys, according to Marcellus's order. But all the conversation is, I guess it's a movie thing. It's Tarantino wants to have people talk. But he's got another guy who's a bit of a sadist, and that is Jules Winfield. So why do you do the big Ezekiel speech? It's just to fuck with people before you pop a cap in his ass, which he says to Tim Roth later on. This is some cold-blooded shit. That was a great opening. Well, secondary scene anyway. Almost opening of Pulp Fiction. Leading to this, one of Tarantino's best scenes ever. This movie is filled with subtitles. Because of the Italian, the German, and the French languages, there are some sequences, one in particular, where there's no English at all. And that's the scene where Shoshana ends up going to lunch with Goebbels and the Julie Dreyfus character. And Landa, and I think Hellstrom is in that scene too. No English whatsoever in that scene. And most scenes have some non-English in them. This movie essentially is a foreign language film. Of course, the brutal violence Tarantino is known for, the Mexican standoffs, and also something that also shouldn't be overlooked, considering this guy has been criticized recently by Uma Thurman for some of the things he's put her through. She's not wrong, I'm not saying that. But at least he has given women the chance to be leads in his movies. The Kill Bill films with Uma Thurman, Jackie Brown, Pam Grier, and even the characters in Death Proof are primarily women that are leads in that. Two sets of them, in fact.
I would even defend Jennifer Jason Leigh's character in Hateful Eight as not necessarily a feminist character, but a refreshingly feminist villain.
Supporting actress nominee, but yeah. Could have been a lead in a way. She was almost more
and
of a lead.
She's a terrible person in that film, but she's a terrible person in a way that I had not seen a woman character be in movies prior to that film. I think people consider it misogynist because they're beating her up through the whole film. But I don't know, I just didn't see it that way. In the same way that I always say, displaying misogyny in a film is not the same as making a misogynist film. I don't think that Hateful Eight is being misogynist in the way that it treats Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. I think that Shoshana as a character is...
She's the lead of this movie.
She's incredible. She's our hero.
No, but
truly.
She's the main character. Yeah, yeah. Brad Pitt gets top billing because he's Brad Pitt. And Christoph Waltz probably has more screen time than she does. It's hard to say because it's an ensemble piece and we spend a lot of time with Pitt and not with her. They never meet, I don't think, do they? They're in some of the scenes in a way. Well, they're in the same place together towards the end, but they're never in any scene together. And Landa meets him and he meets her and he meets... Doesn't meet Fassbender. That's right, he doesn't meet him. Landa spends time with most people in this movie, but he is a supporting player. I think this is her movie, right down to the fact that she's part of the opening scene and she's why the theater explodes. Now, let's get to the ending, I guess, then. I love this notion, and Tarantino, who had to rewrite the screenplay for the course of about 10 years, I guess, it took him a long time to actually finish this
one. Yeah, he worked on the screenplay for a very long time.
And maybe one of the reasons why is that he wanted to go from this kind of weird conceit that they're doing the same thing at the same time. Maybe it's a Bridge on the River Kwai notion, in a way, where they all end up in the same place, this cinema, trying to explode it as well. It's not just that Aldo Raine and the Bastards want to take out one guy, or there's a clandestine thing they got to do. Those three guys are there to try to explode the theater. They're strapped with dynamite.
They're suicide
It's
bombs.
A suicide mission, yeah. Exactly. And she's willing to blow up her own theater, and I guess she's willing to die too, because before she realizes that Zoller, well, she doesn't realize, of course, till it happens, that Zoller ends up killing her, or she kills him. I love how they're born again in a way too in the film, because he's still in the movie that they're watching.
Yeah. So cool.
And then she is, by splicing her own footage, which, by the way, she's lucky that she actually made sure was in there before the Bastards' plan worked out. That worked out really well. The Bastards didn't actually blow up the theater with their dynamite before she got her little movie there, which was also kind of pointless. It's just for our benefit as viewers, I guess, because who cares if Hitler sees this Jewish girl, speaking English, by the way, which they wouldn't understand in that audience.
I know. Why?
And we don't know that she can speak English. We don't think, well, she can't in the opening scene with Landa.
You're in France. Either speak French or speak German, because they're all going to understand German. I think it's just a touch that he's like, I want this scene, this important scene, this beautiful image. I don't want it to be subtitled. I want the audience to be just looking straight at the screen, assuming that they're all English speakers. Like, that's the audience he's making this
for. I read that Melanie Laurent is the one who suggested that to him, that let me speak English in this. I never
it
really...
also is proof that in the scene in the farmhouse at the very beginning, when they're speaking English so that the people under the floorboards won't understand what's going on, but we learn at the end of the film, actually Shoshana could speak English because she's speaking English. So she understood everything that's going on, which is probably what saved her life in that first scene, because she knew to, I don't know, roll away or get away from the shotguns.
Interesting angle on that.
It's not worth nitpicking. I mean, this film is hardly going for accuracy.
You could argue that she also learned English in the years between when she was a little kid in that cellar and to when she's a cinema owner, inheriting it from her.
I mean, she's not a little kid. She's a teenager.
A youngish person then, whatever. Yeah. But she learned English in the meantime. But I think it really is more just conceit, like you just said, that we don't need to see subtitles in that particular moment. And one of the great images in Tarantino's history, because he wasn't a visual filmmaker so much in Reservoir Dogs, which I just watched again a few nights ago, but he wasn't really a visual stylist, even in Pulp Fiction. I wouldn't say it's the prettiest movie of all time. Jackie Brown isn't really either. Getting into Kill Bill, more so, better images. He starts working with Robert Richards, and maybe that's part of the reason why. But the image of Shoshana's face on the smoke from the fire in that theater is one of the great images in any movie in the last 10 years. And it's one of the great images for sure in Tarantino's entire career.
And I'll frequently say that this film, like most Tarantino films, truly gets better every single time I see it. I remember the first time I saw it, it was jarring. I was waiting to discover that Hitler was a decoy or a dream sequence before I put together, oh no, this is just this elaborate fantasy fulfillment of a violent end of one of history's greatest villains. And this is meant to take place in Quentin Tarantino's parallel universe. It's where all of his work lives. The universe where everyone smokes red apple cigarettes.
And Hitler dies.
World War II
Manson
ended
dies,
when Hitler was slaughtered in a movie theater. I love, too, that the movie theater is playing a propaganda film, a World War II film, and it could be viewed as this commentary on the honesty of all war films. The slaughter
the Americans
takes
did the
place.
Exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly. The slaughter takes place during the screening of Nation's Pride, a piece of propaganda extolling the heroic exploits of a soldier that was surely meant to have been an exaggeration, just as you say, like so many Hollywood war films have been this thinly veiled, exaggerated propaganda. So as Tarantino is making his own very pro-America World War II film, it's this big wink, wink. Look at me. I know what I'm doing. So I'm about to kill Hitler and you're all going to feel real proud of America in a few minutes. But let's all be reminded that this is all artifice.
I read that Eli Roth is the one that actually shot the propaganda film.
Yeah, he directed Nation's Pride.
And he shot it very quickly. Eli Roth is mostly a director. He's been in some films here and there as an actor, but he's mostly directed his own almost snuff films. We'll get to snuff in a second, by the way. But Hostel, he's best known for that, which I actually had issues with. Call Me Sick wasn't violent enough.
Yeah, if you're going to be just violent, you better really bring it.
Yeah, I appreciated what he did, but it almost should have been more sickening than it was. But Eli Roth is in that Kevin Smith, John Waters mode. Kevin Smith I like more than his other two guys, films-wise. Great raconteur. He's terrific on podcasts. He's a smart guy. The History of Horror thing he did on, what was it? Last fall. I forget what the station was that put that out there. That was fascinating stuff. I like Eli Roth as a guy. Maybe we'll find out he's an asshole long-term. But what I've seen from him so far, he is a fascinating dude. I'd love to sit down and just talk to him about movies. Obviously, Tarantino would be the dream with that. But maybe Eli Roth is up there with him. And they became friends. This is a movie about movies. You've got a cinema owner. You've got an actor. You've got Michael Fassbender. I'd forgotten this detail. Was a former film critic.
Oh, yeah!
Which seems like Tarantino masturbating himself a little bit much, maybe, to have this many movies within movies. But it is what he does. It's true. Okay, let's get back to the actual Bastards, because that's the name of the movie. And they're in the movie a lot, but it's not really their movie. Like we said, Shoshana is the lead, really, more so. And let's not overlook some of the great performances in smaller roles, like August D.L.S. Hellstrom in that scene in the basement. But I want to talk about the Bastards first. They slaughter Nazis. We see them taking scalps many times in the film. Rain interrogating the guy. Oblige him! And the Donnie Donowitz coming down and bashing the bat against the side of that tunnel. Over and over and over again. And then he, of course, hammers the guy's head
and we
slaughters
see
him.
Yeah.
And Tarantino does not. And, well, he shouldn't, really. He was always called a violence guy. And watching Reservoir Dogs again just a few days ago, and I know this is true about Pulp Fiction, he didn't really show you that much violence. You think you see violence in Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and some of the other films he made. Kill Bill is more blatant, because that's sort of the point of it.
Yeah.
But those first two movies are not that visually violent. You just think you're seeing shit.
And Kill Bill's cartoonish.
But I think the idea is, let's have revisionist history, but a real thing. So if you're going to do that, then I want to see people get their heads torn off, whether the top of their heads torn off with scalping. I want to see Hitler get shredded with bullets. I want to see people poking their fingers in bullet holes to torture actresses. There's another thing, an actress.
Yes,
so a film critic, an actress, an actor, and a cinema owner are four major characters in this movie. And speaking of the actor and the theater owner, Shoshana is really pushing up against and almost having to cross the line. Well, she's not. But Zoller's crossing the line of the Me Too stuff. He doesn't do anything to her, I guess. He doesn't actually touch her. But she says no more than once, and he just keeps on pushing. But he's a Nazi, so he can do what he wants to. I'm actually impressed in a way that Tarantino didn't have him try something more directly because he's a Nazi. And why wouldn't he? Because you think you're going to rule the world. And at that moment of France, especially France, but in Europe, you are ruling that area. I'm not saying it's cool, of course, but I'm almost surprised that he didn't just rape her or take what he wanted from her.
My favorite thing about Zoller as a character is that for most of his arc, even right up to the final showdown in the movie theater, if he weren't a Nazi, we would be rooting for him to get the girl. He has all that charming persistence of a Hollywood romantic lead, and then it's a sinister twist on that cliche nice boy who won't take no for an answer trope.
She's blatantly saying no more than most Hollywood movies.
How many movies can you think of where there's the girl who's just like no, and then he's just so charming and persistent, and eventually he wins her over? He's playing right into that.
I feel like this movie and Tarantino, for all of his criticisms from Uma Thurman that are probably deserved, is more feminist aware than a lot of directors are, even back before that became in vogue, like it's been the last few years.
Well, I don't think Uma Thurman's criticisms were that he was sexist. He played far too fast and loose with actors' safety, which wasn't just true of her in Kill Bill or in the choking scenes in both Kill Bill and in Glorious Bastards. There's also a story about that fire in that theater and how they got lucky because it burned way hotter than they expected it to. And there were a couple of actors, I think Eli Roth included, who were just lucky.
I think it's a shot where Omar Doom is his name, who plays Omer, and then Eli Roth, who plays Donowitz, are just firing in the crowd, and you see the fire behind them. I believe that's the one where I was reading that Tarantino was in a fire suit on a crane shooting this, but they were seconds away, because I think maybe the thing actually collapsed. But anyway, these guys were already hot, and apparently it was seconds away from that was going to collapse, and these guys would have been badly injured, maybe even killed, from both fire and from maybe a fall from that set they're on collapsing. So yes, he does push it too hard, but that's also a film director thing. So yeah, maybe he's not known to be a sexist director. I guess that's true.
And it's funny that this movie was produced by Harvey Weinstein, and yet it is a great early illustration of what it's like for a woman with a power imbalance trying to say no to a man who's simply persistent. And you can completely believe that Frederick, right up until the end when she really tells him no and gets in his face about it and is no longer polite about it. But as long as she is borderline polite...
He's John Cusack.
Yes, he's John Cusack. He's just holding the beatbox to play the song for her while she's just trying desperately to tell him in every language possible.
Hey, he's a Nazi, but maybe we don't know at that point. I don't think we do until later on. She's in love with Marcel, the black guy.
Very early on, she calls him my love when she's on the marquee. At the end of the first scene where she meets Zoller, she sees him and she's like, thanks, my love, or something. Okay. And you're like, oh, okay, they're together.
Could be an expression, though. Friendly expression.
I guess so. I recall the first time I saw the movie, I was like, oh, they're a couple. I figured it out pretty quickly.
I love the notion, though, that a black guy and a Jewish girl combined to kill a whole load of major Nazis as well.
But it also plays the fact that she can't say to Zoller, I have a boyfriend. Who's your boyfriend? Yeah. Oh, my boyfriend is this black man. Oh, that's so funny. We have a thing about black men around here.
Marcel
with the
would be dead.
He would be dead. So she actually has to lie and pretend that she's single. And as a matter of fact, I imagine even in non-Nazi occupied France, it might be dangerous for a white woman to admit to having a relationship with a black man.
It's a little bit dangerous in some parts of this part of the world now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
2019.
So they have to keep their relationship a secret. That makes her extra vulnerable to Zoller, who is just adorably persistent until it's not adorable any longer. And it's funny how this film seems to actually portray the sinister side of that persistence, that romantic trope of the guy that won't take no for an answer.
Cast a good actor too, and Daniel Brühl in that role, because he was lauded in Rush not that many years after this. People loved him in that supporting role.
Oh my god,
in
the Ron Howard film. I didn't know that either.
I had to look it up. I thought I recognized the name. I thought, yeah, that's the guy that people said should have been nominated for an Oscar for that. He wasn't nominated for Rush, which also had Chris Hemsworth in it too, but Brühl is the one that people talked about so much. And he's also the bad guy in Captain America Civil War. He's Baron Zemo. He's already put together one hell of a resume. I mentioned August Diehl in the basement scene. We'll get to that in 1 second. As Hellstrom, I think maybe possibly the best role in the whole movie. But just a little bit more about Shoshana first, because the lunch scene with Goebbels and Hellstrom and Zoller, Landa comes in there at the end. Julie Dreyfus's character's in there as well. What is Julie Dreyfus's name? Where is she on this? She is Francesca Mondino. I don't remember actually saying that name. So if I say Julie Dreyfus, you know who I'm talking about.
Goebbels' girlfriend.
Right. And Shoshana's got to contain her fear, but also rage in that whole sequence. I wouldn't say it's the most important scene in the whole movie, because she probably would have tried to kill them when she finds out Hitler's coming to her theater anyway. But I think in a way that scene puts it across even more, because she maybe recognized his voice. She probably knew who he was. I don't know that Landa would know who he was talking to, but when he asks...
What do you think? Do you think he knows who she is?
Well, he suggests she drinks milk.
Yeah.
Which he wanted early milk in the farmhouse, which had nothing to do with her per se, but she was in that same farmhouse. And then also he, apparently, I didn't know this until I read this in the trivia, this was way over my head, great research by Tarantino, that he gives her, what was it again?
Strudel.
Strudel, right, which apparently was not kosher. So she's not supposed to eat it, and I think she does, maybe because she feels like, okay, I'm Jewish, but I gotta do this before
she takes one bite.
I might get killed. So but again, say, he's fucking with somebody.
Oh yeah, exactly. He's playing with her. I believe he knows. He just doesn't care because at this point he knows the war's ending. He probably is way more concerned about what he's heard about the bastards coming and sabotaging it. He seems to be on to them. And I'm sure he wouldn't have thought Shoshana's gonna blow the theater up.
Mm-hmm.
He would probably assume that Shoshana would just try to fly under the radar, do everything to make everything go smoothly.
Which is what she was doing for 4 years, or 3 years, whatever it was.
He would enjoy, in a way, the spectacle of her pretending to enjoy hosting this premiere in her theater without necessarily knowing that she was going to blow it up, because who would ever assume that?
You know what? Landa would never have found out about that except from hearsay later on, because he's left that area, as has Rain, as has Yudovich. They don't know the theater blew up. The way it did, at least. They didn't know the theater got blown up and also burned down. It was a combination of the dynamite that the bastards brought in there, but also the burning down. So one
nobody
or another,
may know. Outside of that theater, nobody may know that she did what she did because
the bastards were doing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. They would actually attribute all of her work to the bastards, who would have probably been successful
that
anyway.
That wanted the credit anyway.
Who is it that actually locks the doors?
It's Marcel.
It's Marcel that
Marcel
locks
goes to the front and locks them in, and then he goes to the back. There's a question. Because unlike Gremlins, the end of that movie, where they try to blow up a theater and kill all the Gremlins, and they do kill all the Gremlins except for Stripe, who gets over to the department store, and then they have a big climax of that movie later on.
Of all the movies to compare this to, carry on.
I bet that's Tarantino, Mr. Film Referencer,
probably
is honoring that.
Right.
How many movies have had a theater explosion in one of the ends moments? Because it's not the last moment of this movie, it wasn't the last moment of Gremlins. How many movies have had that as one of their big moments, one of their big climaxes? In this movie, though, everybody who was in that cinema that stayed in there, at least, died, except my question is, did Marcel, after he says, "We, Shoshana," and flicks a cigarette to burn up that nitrate film, does he quickly get the hell out the back?
I hope so. I like to think that he did. Why would he die in the theater?
We don't see him.
She may have planned an escape as well.
But Zola ruins it, yeah.
She maybe was supposed to get away. I don't think that she was meant to die in that theater.
I don't know. She's up in the projection booth. She's got a long way to go to get the hell out of there. And she can't go at the front because he's locked the front. I bet, in fact, no, you know what? I'm saying that she definitely intended to kill herself to make sure it happened, to make sure, definitely, that Hitler and the rest of them are going to die. And one of the reasons why I say that is because you see her when she puts the makeup on, the way she stripes across her face, like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver when he does the mohawk. Apparently that was something that they did in Vietnam. If I'm going over the edge and I'm not coming back,
oh,
they'll do a mohawk. That's why he does that in Taxi Driver, one of Tarantino's favorite movies. Well, her version of that is
the war paint.
The war paint that I'm putting on my face. And then you see that she just smears it in like you do blush. But the way she starts that is, this is my last day on Earth, and I'm going out taking out these motherfuckers.
She's badass. She's such a great hero. Mm-hmm.
Melanie Laurent didn't do a ton of movies after this either. Beginners with Christopher Plummer, she's in that. And By the Sea with Pitt and Angelina Jolie, she's in that too.
Oh, yeah.
I think she's also in Now You See Me, but her film resume is not that impressive since. Just like Christoph Waltz. You get the right director with it. Apparently, she was effectively discovered. He wanted to discover somebody, Tarantino said, and then he said, "You're a little too famous," and she said, "I'm not that famous." I never
and
heard of
her
before.
Maybe she's famous around French people, but considering most of his audience, it's not going to be that. Michael, she's an excellent actress. She's a wonderful actress. Her performance is incredible. The way she plays peril, the way she plays fear, and the way she has that fear, but she's trying to be cool, is super convincing. Just that perfect balance of the audience can see what's going on in her head. And of course, if she was actually sitting at that table behaving like that, everybody around her would figure out something was wrong. But it's just that perfect balance of us knowing what's going on in her head without her really truly giving it away.
You mean the lunch table?
The lunch table. Also, a couple scenes with Zoller.
I think you could argue at the lunch table that because the Nazis would realize that they're intimidating the French, they're all cowering to us, and they would like that. They'd love the ass-kissing.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mentioned Michael Fassbender, or tried to a second ago. Another guy that, I don't know if Tarantino discovered him, but I'd never heard his name before this movie.
No, me neither.
Maybe 30 minutes of screen time, probably less in total. But that basement sequence leads to two Mexican standoffs, which Brad Pitt's character actually calls a Mexican, maybe it's the other guy. But anyway, it's called a Mexican standoff the first time ever. Tarantino's had these in, I think, almost every movie. Reservoir Dogs had it at the ending. Pulp Fiction has it at the ending. Stiglitz has the gun at the guy's Nazi balls, and those two guys have guns at each other, and then everyone gets killed. Almost everyone gets killed in that basement. Bridget manages to survive that.
She loses a shoe. Like Cinderella.
Yeah, the Cinderella moment, sure. But the accent that isn't quite right in the fingers when he asks for three glasses that gave Hitchcock away. I do like when Pitt says, "It's a fucking basement. It's in a fucking basement," many times. Now, Hitchcock's is speaking German. I'm assuming it's pretty good. I don't think it matters that much.
He was born in Germany. Fassbender was.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm assuming that it's believable enough. But the point becomes that the character is not speaking it quite right. Because that's why
he's an Englishman.
Hellstrom picks up on it. So I asked this, why didn't they just use Stiglitz, who also should have been more famous and should have been recognized by those people? He had become a pretty well-known. He's the Red Baron of the other side.
He's there.
Exactly. So why isn't he the guy that's doing the talking rather than having a guy who isn't speaking proper German? Because Stiglitz would have spoken proper German.
It's because Hickox fucks it up. Everything would have been fine, except that when they get interrupted by that guy who's like, my baby was born today. Mm. What's his name? Wilhelm or something. He's interrupting them and he's annoying. He's drunk and he's being a nuisance. And she's famous, so he's trying to talk to her. And then there's a point where Hickox just gets impatient. He's like, why don't you fuck off? I'm an officer. You're an enlisted man. Get out of our way. We're trying to enjoy ourselves. If he had not said that, then nobody would have heard his accent because they would have been having a private conversation.
Hellstrom is in the next room.
He just got impatient. All he had to do was be cool. All they had to do was have one drink, let her do the talking. How about that? She's the only one that anybody wants to talk to anyway. Mm. Let her do all the talking. She seems to be doing a great job of keeping her cool, but he blew it. That's the moment, actually, that everything goes sideways.
Before the fingers end being
Because they wouldn't have drawn attention to themselves. They would have had one drink, because she says to them, we can't show up at a bar and immediately leave. We have to have one drink, and then we can go, because obviously the situation is not ideal here, but we gotta be cool and keep our cover. That's all he has to do is be cool. Just sit there, say nothing. You're the quiet guy. Nobody's going to be suspicious of that. But he had to open his mouth because he was annoyed.
I was never the biggest fan of Diane Kruger. She was in Troy. She's Helen in Helen of Troy. And she and Orlando Bloom are the love interest in that movie. Brad Pitt's in that too, because he's Achilles. Neither of them is worth any of this. He steals her away from the Grecians. I forget. He steals her away from the other side and they attack Troy. And that's why that big war even happens. She wasn't worth it, and neither was Orlando Bloom's character. And I wasn't impressed with her as an actress in that movie. I remember thinking, this girl, yeah, she's pretty, but what the hell? But then she's great in this movie, and she's also really good in The Fade a couple years ago. So she's obviously a talented actress, but then you work with Tarantino, and whatever talents you have come out even more. And she apparently is basically Marlene Dietrich, who was also a double agent I was reading during World War II, it must have been.
That's amazing.
But she's an actress, and I like that touch. And then, of course, you mentioned the Cinderella shoe, and she is choked out by Landa. I guess she must die. Well, she definitely dies in that theater. They all do.
Her death,
But she doesn't even last until the theater blows up, does she? And that was Tarantino actually doing the choking. He wanted to get to the point where he realized, okay, she's actually choking, and then we say cut. But let's make this look real.
Yeah, you got to see the tears come out of their eyes. And listen, I don't approve of this. I think it comes more from his passion for getting the moment that he wants and getting the performance that he wants.
It is authentic.
It is authentic, but it's a pretty twisted thing that he does. You got to question his motivations, but some pretty authentic looking choking.
He wish he could have choked her feet.
Oh, well, there's plenty of foot stuff between the Cinderella thing and then even her bizarre high-heeled cast. It all plays into his foot fetish, which is, well known.
I hope his now wife has nice feet.
She must, because it seems to be the only thing the man cares about.
So in that fucking basement, as Rain says many times, there's that great card game on their heads. And then Hellstrom has
King Kong. Oh, my God.
I'd never heard this before. I don't know if Tarantino came up with this, but the King Kong is an allegory for the American slave trade. Had you ever heard that before?
I can't remember.
So if it's Tarantino's thing,
with Tarantino anyway.
If it says, then kudos to him, because that is, and maybe it wasn't intentional, but one hell of a good example of what's really going on. He's brought to America in chains against his will and then dies. Not all the slaves died. Obviously, many of them lived on, but they didn't want to be there. Brought from a foreign country in chains. So as for Hellstrom in that scene, I think he's fantastic, Augustine. Not to credit Nazi bravery, but then I hate when people pull that shit. They can't be brave. Terrorists can't be brave. No, anybody, no matter what their motivations are for doing what they're doing, can be brave. And he knows early on he has to kill them, and he stays anyway. He could just play ignorant. No one would ever find out that he saw these guys in this bar and realized, nah, that doesn't seem right to me. He doesn't know that they're the wrong people anyway. He guesses they are, and he does figure it out even more so with the wrong fingers. And then when Hickox actually owns up the fact, oh boy, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out speaking the kings. Hellstrom knows he's right. But you got to credit the guy's courage for staying there 1-on-4. Well, 3, really, because Bridget is not going to shoot him back. Although she does kill somebody in that scene later on. She kills Wilhelm at the very end. But when he goes up against those guys, it's a suicide mission. We think about the bastards in the theater as a suicide mission with 3 people. Well, his 1-on-3 is a suicide mission, too.
That's a good point.
And again, Landa does fuck with Bridget because he knows before he ever actually meets her in person at the theater towards the end of the movie that she's his Huckleberry. He's got her Cinderella shoe, but he fucks with her too. He fucks with everybody.
Mm-hmm. So Tarantino obviously loves violence. This scene, the theater scene, he loves to indulge in violent scenarios. And I think that in most of his films, he seems to design the premise simply to give the heroes permission to indulge in some imaginatively vicious acts without ever losing support of the audience. You make your villain a redneck rapist, or a slave owner, or literally Hitler, and now he has permission to dive headfirst into the worst thing his imagination can concoct. This probably sounds like an indictment, but I love it. It gives me permission to enjoy it, too. To get the titillating thrill of violence in a scene like this, or a scene like the theater, without any of the moral squeamishness.
I will quote what he said many years ago. I don't like violence in reality. I like it in movies.
Because it can be fun in movies. It's like video games. The rise of video games has actually been correspondent with a decline in violence in real life. Just because we see it in our art doesn't mean...
Joe Lieberman lied to me?
Yes.
Video games are the problem.
No, they're not. The more there are violent video games, the less that there is violence in real life.
We're also a violent culture. I always think of the Fahrenheit 9/11 scene where Michael Moore is badgering Charlton Heston, who has all kinds of explanations he thinks are why America has more gun deaths than anywhere else in the world. I wish Heston had just said, this is my opinion, I might be wrong, but I think that we're a violent culture in general. Culture in the whole world. Yes, it's better in some parts of the world, but we're not innocent. If you eat meat, you have been participant in a creature dying.
But my point isn't whether or not culture is violent. It is whether or not we can simply indulge in the enjoyment of watching violence in our art. I literally do not kill bugs, except mosquitoes. They don't count. I hate centipedes, and we have a house full of them, and I will never kill them.
They're not
fun. I hate...
There's some. Listen, they go after her.
They go
me.
After me all the time.
I haven't seen one in months.
I see them every day. So anyway, I don't kill them, but I can enjoy violence in films, and I just don't think it's necessarily the same thing.
Well, you're right. When he casts Samuel L. Jackson as a black man, but who is probably the biggest sadist in Django Unchained, or the Nazis, so many of them, Landa, but especially Hitler, of course. Some of the things that happen in Kill Bill, and on and on and on.
I think he writes his script specifically to allow for violence.
Yeah.
To make the audience give the hero permission to absolutely go buck wild, and then they do, and then we enjoy it.
I don't think I cheered when you see Hitler get shredded by that machine gun, but I thought about it.
It feels good.
Gonna bring it up again. I don't know what's gonna happen, because we haven't seen the movie yet, obviously, but I have a feeling Manson. That Charles Manson is gonna be a bloody mess before that movie's over. And maybe Sharon Tate and her friends will live this time, because he does have a big star playing that character, Margot Robbie. Okay, so in the ending sequence, Landon knows about the two bastards. He finds out that Ulmer and Donowitz are still out there, but he does capture Rain. And, of course, that's partly because he wants Rain to get him out, to get his nice deal to go to the States. And when Rain asks Yudovich, would you make that deal? I'd make that deal. I remember saying to you, I would too.
Yeah, of course.
Even if they didn't make that Nazi insignia on his forehead that he'll have to have the rest of his life.
Still worth it.
So what?
Yeah.
If this terrible person lives, but you end the war and you also get rid of every major German leader, four of them in one fell swoop, fine. Let Landa live with blowjobs and caviar the rest of his life. He doesn't have to have that thing on his forehead. I would do it in a second.
It's actually refreshing that a movie just kind of lets that happen, in a sense that in a lot of movies would have the hero find some excuse to kill him in the end. He would get his, but no, realistically, that's still the smart thing to do, just to end the war. You're going to save way more lives than he'll destroy in his future.
Well, so what's Rain going to do? Because he's the one who's captured, but he agrees to the deal because it makes sense, and because he doesn't want to actually... Well, then again, he would be willing to go down. He was willing to go down that night, wasn't he? He was going to blow himself up. But it's very smart. He doesn't seem like the smartest character in the world, but he is a crafty guy, obviously. When Landa took the dynamite off of Rain's ankle, he planted in Hitler's box. So even more so, he's making sure that the Führer and Goebbels are going to die. Maybe the theater thing wasn't going to work. He doesn't know that they're going to burn the thing down, but the explosions would have happened. Actually, as it turns out, they were all in the box because they were both on those two guys' ankles.
Yeah, that's right.
And the third one from Pitt's ankle was also in the box. It wasn't supposed to be. So obviously, Hans Landa's going to get his deal. He's going to go to the States and have a normal life, but he's going to have to wear some kind of headband the rest of his life. He's going to be Hulk Hogan, wear a do-rag or something like that, I guess.
He's so going to become a real hat aficionado.
He will be picked out very much, I guess. And that is, of course, leading to the masterpiece line that Pitt has at the very ending, which is a great touch, because if he doesn't do that, I don't know how you actually end the movie, but you could find a way to end the movie and still have it be fairly satisfying. But right down to the whole shooting the driver and, that man didn't do anything, he surrendered to you. Nah, they don't want him, they want you. Some of the
Nazi.
Laughs.
We kill Nazis.
There's not a lot of laughs in this movie, but the last half hour or so have, I would say almost all of them, but especially the Goebbels thing. I think that's so fucking funny. Thank you, my viewer. Okay, I mentioned snuff a while ago, and a snuff film kind of thing, But Brad Pitt is often doing snuff in this movie. It's almost like he's doing his little shot of cocaine, which he's not. It's supposed to be the snuff thing. It's an interesting touch. It's almost like he has to get up.
That's what he's snorting.
Yeah. And he's called Aldo the Apache. He's got Native American roots. He's a bootlegger. He admits to that. Was he lynched? There's a scar on his neck that suggests he was. He's a southerner, so he has seen some shit. He also is an Italian stuntman, or pretending to be, in this movie, when he does say, Buongiorno! And he is playing a stuntman at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We've covered him in Thelma and Louise in 7. Had such a great career. He's an actor I always thought was underrated. And if he died tomorrow, what a career this guy's had.
He's had so many great roles. And he's really defied the pretty boy label that people wanted to put on him. I think he's such an interesting actor. A really great example of him taking things almost over the top. I think it was Roger Ebert's review that says that the actors don't eat the scenery, but they lick the scenery. And I thought that was such a great way to put it. And him and, of course, Waltz are great examples of that, where they're pushing it right to the edge where it's almost comical, but then...
That's a bingo!
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Ooh, that's...
Is that how you say it? He's going to be an American now. He's got to learn their way of speaking.
Oh, my God. So great.
Michael Fassbender has now played Magneto, the vicious slave owner in 12 Years a Slave, Steve Jobs... He's David in the Alien prequels. What a career this guy's already had. And this could have been Simon Pegg or even Tim Roth.
Simon Pegg. I can't imagine it.
Mm. I like him.
Again, but... I trust Tarantino to pull it off. Tim Roth, I could see it. I could definitely see it.
He worked with him a couple times before. And then he would again in Hateful Eight, but he was in Dogs and he was in Pulp Fiction. And then Till Schweiger is Stiglitz, who doesn't have a lot of screen time and certainly doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but he's pretty powerful. I wouldn't say he steals the movie because he doesn't really do that much, but he is really effective in that role. And I was reading that he would never play a Nazi in movies despite his German heritage, but when he found out he could kill Nazis, I'll play a German. And he wore a Nazi uniform, but for that sake.
Speaking of Germans and Nazis, the marketing in this film, they had to have a whole separate marketing campaign because you are not allowed to use the swastika.
In Germany.
In Germany. You can if it's a piece of art, so they could leave it in the film because that's considered a piece of art, but the marketing is not, so they had to remove all of the swastikas from the posters and trailers specifically for a German audience.
B.J. Novak is Yudovich, the last surviving bastard, along with Brad Pitt, although apparently Sam Levine, who is one of the bastards, has said he survived, and we were supposed to see a scene with him meeting up later on, and maybe Tarantino realized in the editing with Sally Menke. No, the movie ends with, Yudovich, I believe this may be my masterpiece, but Levine supposedly survived, too. I think the other bastards all do die.
Well, anybody who's not in the theater, why would they die?
I guess that's fairly true, yeah. But the last two we see are Yudovich and Rain. Mike Myers has that small role. He hadn't really done a lot of movies at that point. He hasn't made that many movies since then, but he just say Operation Kino. And then Rod Taylor from The Birds, we covered that last fall, is Churchill. Barely speaks. There's all these entries on the IMDb about all the prep he did, and he has maybe 3 lines as Churchill. He's just basically somebody you see rather than actually hear. And Harvey Keitel, the voice of the guy who actually makes a deal with Landa. He's the one on the intercom.
I knew that.
Right, yeah. One of Tarantino's favorites back from Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction. Sam Jackson is a narrator, which doesn't really seem all that necessary, but we do hear him talking about Stiglitz and a few other things.
Tarantino is in it twice as 2 different characters. He's one of the soldiers that dies in the film Nation's Pride, the film within a film. Oh. And he's one of the Nazi soldiers. I should say, I think they made a model of his body to be one of the Nazi soldiers getting scalped.
Oh, okay. All right, fair. And then again, kudos to August Diehl as Hellstrom, because I think that might be one of the more underrated roles in the whole film. He is the guy that has the giant boot. One of the great touches by Tarantino. The Sherlock Holmes pipe.
Oh my God.
That's in the opening scene. And then the giant boot glass that Hellstrom has in that basement bar scene.
Tarantino said he always wanted to have the pipe in that scene for the obvious comparison between the corncob pipe and this ridiculous, huge, elaborate rich man's pipe, which is also a Sherlock Holmes pipe because Landa is a detective. And then he said that once him and Waltz were talking about the character, they decided that Landa doesn't actually smoke a pipe, and you never actually see him really properly smoke the pipe. The pipe is always performance for him, toying with Lapidite. He pretends that he's going to smoke this pipe just so he can pull it out and have this ridiculous moment with him.
So in a movie about movies with so many people who are in some way related to the film industry, here's a guy who in no way is a film actor, but is an actor.
Oh, he's always performing.
300 plus episodes of this podcast, we've talked about it many times. Actors who are playing characters who are acting for the other people on screen. All right, Tarantino, we've covered him many times. Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, The Kill Bills. Tarantino is always his own writer. Another good screenplay, of course. I was reading he didn't learn how to speak French or German, and Italian, I guess, too. Despite the amount of those languages in this movie, he just trusted whoever was on set to make sure that they were giving the performances properly.
It's easier said than done. Learn a language. It's not just something you can do on the weekend.
I guess that's probably true. There have been plenty of filmmakers. Spielberg has made movies with Germans, and obviously Saving Private Ryan. He had to trust somebody else, unless he learned German, to tell him what they were actually saying and make sure they were saying it properly.
While we're talking about Tarantino, I kind of have some fresh takes about his work while I was watching and thinking about this film. The way he borrows stuff, the title itself of Inglourious Basterds is borrowed from a 1978, I think it's an Italian war film?
Spelled properly, too.
Spelled properly in that film, but he borrows it from that film.
Enzo Castellari.
He's heavily influenced. Like you said, we did that Sergio Leone film 2 episodes ago. We did Once Upon a Time in the West. He considered calling this film Once Upon a Time in Nazi-occupied France. He heavily borrows things, and people sometimes criticize him of copying, but every single artist borrows from the art that came before them. Tarantino does something different, though. It could almost be likened to a DJ sampling someone else's music to create something that borrows on the cultural cachet of the original work, but still creates something entirely fresh and new.
And often very much better.
Tarantino has this uncanny ability to take the emotional reactions we have to those cultural touchstones and turn them on us, either to take advantage of the emotion that we're already feeling because of that piece of music or that name of a character, or just something that's going to remind us of this thing that we like, or to take it and turn it on its head and create something that's the complete opposite and mess with our emotions. He performs all this irony also from a place of unironic love for the original piece of work. And mm-hmm. You talked about how you think maybe he's referencing Gremlins when he blows up the theater.
Probably is.
Gremlins, which is something that, even though it was a very popular film, it was considered corny, just pop, and something that's unimportant and not something that's worth considering art.
But also was an homage to old movies, including This Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Apparently that was the nightmare version of that. And then just old monster movies.
So often, he takes this work that's considered lowbrow or even trashy, and he elevates it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think of him, if anybody listening knows the artist Girl Talk, I think he's like the filmmaker version of Girl Talk, that he understands sampling in a way that I think most artists don't.
And I'll also quote Francis Ford Coppola when he was on Inside the Actor's Studio, and he said that everyone steals, and he loves it. He thinks it's very important to do that, and people should do that. Now, he meant when it came to painting, and he meant with film, and he meant with any kind of art there is. Especially if you're going to do what Tarantino does, more than most people have ever done, and elevate it, like you just said, and make it even better. Who cares about the original 1978 Enzo Castellari version of Inglourious Basterds?
But he wants you to care about it. We talk about that scene with the French farmer at the beginning. And he uses Fleur Elise, I'm probably pronouncing that in a butchered way, but he uses this really familiar piece of music. Mm. Anyone who ever took piano lessons knows. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And he knows we're going to be super familiar with it, and yet he finds this way to transcend it into this tremendous tension-building piece of music.
My point with that is that Inglourious Basterds, the original, is not a bad movie. I've never seen it. But this guy likes the trashy movies, generally.
Yeah.
This isn't somebody who's saying,
he wants us to like it.
This is a piece of shit. No, apparently when he was, well, he has an actual bona fide theater in his house and has for a long time now. But when he was starting to get big, people would say they'd go over to his house and he'd be watching stuff on the worst print you'd ever imagine and some piece of crap. That it wasn't Lawrence of Arabia on his big home theater. It wasn't Citizen Kane in some great print.
Roger Corman.
Or it wasn't the newest print that
it's
was
like
going to come out.
Italian version of Roger Corman or something.
Yeah, and it wasn't some movie that was going to come out in 2 months that he got a print for and he's watching that now. It was trash you could have gotten on VHS that would have looked probably even better than what he was watching. But that's what he loves and that's what he's benefited from. And yes, he's homaged plenty of movies you've known very well in many cases. And if you want to see all that stuff, then look at the IMDb entry in this movie, because I'm not going to bother telling you all of it right now. There's way too many of them, and some of them that you don't recognize. Apparently, Bo Svenson is in this movie. I don't remember what the role is right now, but he's also in the original. I think he's the lead in the original Inglourious Basterds. So let's get to the last thoughts on a great movie, which I've seen, I think, at least 5 times, maybe more now. Inglourious Basterds, which I believe was my 2nd favorite movie of that year. When I ranked them, I had Hurt Locker number 1. If I had to redo it, Hurt Locker wouldn't be number 1. Up would still be up there for sure. Up in the Air would be. And this obviously would be too. Maybe this would be number 1 now if I had to redo it.
The film can be divisive, but I will plant myself firmly, obviously, in the camp of the fans. And I'll say something maybe a little more controversial, that I think that Inglourious Basterds is pound for pound as good as Pulp Fiction. My favorite Tarantino film is Kill Bill. That's no secret. But if I were to say what is his best film, I don't know. It would be a tough choice between this and Pulp Fiction.
Dan Murrow from Screen Junkies agrees with you, I think, because he was talking about that recently, that he thinks that maybe the recent stuff is as good or better.
I would only say that about this and Kill Bill. I don't think that Django or Hateful Eight are...
I think maybe he does think that, though, so he's sort of on the same line of thinking as you are. This is one of the best foreign language films you'll ever see, with some excellent performances, pretty much across the board. Great tension, and as always with Quentin Tarantino, what a script. This isn't quite a masterpiece, but it's up there.
It might be a masterpiece. Every time I watch it, I like it better.
When we return in 7 days, we'll get away from all this Nazi death, well-deserved though it may be, and gab about Ron Howard's 30-year-old dramedy, Parenthood. Another great cast with cross-the-board good performances. The coming attractions trivia for Parenthood. We talk a lot about the Oscars in the 300-plus episodes we've done in this podcast. Many great actors have never won one, will never win, and might never even be nominated. Name three living actors you'd like to see win an honorary award for their body of work, because they probably never will get a nomination, or if they ever do, it's going to be when they're old and gray.
All right, so for our answers to that question, please check out our next podcast about Parenthood. If you can't wait until then, and you just need more Ryan and Bev in your life, well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe the Top 100 Project on either Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. And many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. And it is not case-sensitive.
I'm going to be the one to end this podcast and say... coupe, which is cut in French.
And coupe.
All right, you'll be the one to end this podcast. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da.